Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, acknowledging the vital work of local public health departments to keep Californians safe during the pandemic. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, we continue our election coverage by checking in with young voters about the issues that matter to them the most. And we take a look at some local congressional races. But first, let's turn to the presidential race. Kern County is known for big agriculture and traditionally leans to the right. Many of the farmers there support Donald Trump. But when it comes to immigration, FM89's Madi Bolaños reports, not all the farmers there line up behind him.
Tom France is a fourth-generation almond farmer in Shafter, California. It's a small town of 16,000 people just up the road from Bakersfield. Fields in the area grow almond, pistachios, cotton, grapes, and alfalfa. France says he relies on a local contractor to provide workers he needs to tend his farm.
And he'll bring 20 people will show up, and they all have the equipment they need.
He explains to the contractor what the job entails, whether it's heavy or lighter pruning, what to do with branches, and how to lay them out. But France says he does not get involved with the paperwork.
When he sends me the bill, he gives me the name of every worker and their Social Security number. And from that, I'm supposed to assume that everyone is legal, and I'm not required to check each person myself.
When I asked Tom France what he thinks of President Trump's harsh rhetoric and clampdown on immigration across the U.S.-Mexico border, he says it's leading to a decline in farm workers.
So a shortage of workers can put someone out of business real fast if you don't have the people to do the job.
This 71-year-old almond farmer in Shafter says he disagrees with Donald Trump on many issues, but immigration is a big one. And he says it's enough to keep him from casting his ballot for Trump this fall. He says he didn't vote for him back in 2016 either. And he says American consumers in general could be hurt by these immigration policies.
That in the end ultimately has to raise the cost of food, but then you have international trade agreements come into effect as well. And if the cost of growing something is too high in one place, another place may be able to do it quite a bit cheaper, even after shipping the goods halfway around the world.
30 miles down Highway 99 is a much larger operation run by Dennis Johnston. He was also born and raised in Kern County. Johnston Farms grows citrus fruit, potatoes, and bell peppers. The farm employs nearly 100 full-time packing workers and another 300 during the harvest season. He says all of the workers at his farm are required to fill out a federal I-9 form. So
the assumption on our part is they are all documented, or we couldn't hire them legally.
But he says the industry needs more seasonal workers.
If you just relied on the legal immigration system, there isn't enough employees coming to replenish the migrant labor that are here and working now, that are retiring, going to work in other industries.
It's no secret that many of the farm workers in this country are undocumented. The U.S. Agriculture Department says as many as half. Some farmers and labor contractors have estimated it's more like three quarters. Gabriela Lopez is an immigration attorney with Eaton & Associates in Bakersfield and represents farm workers facing deportation. She says the Trump administration's tougher enforcement has many more Central Valley residents asking for legal help and support.
We were seeing many people in our office coming and saying that they were detained on their way to work, and most of these people were farm workers.
People like Lopez say there's been an uptick in arrests by ICE agents as part of a larger sweep in California's agricultural heartland. Lopez says family members often come to her on behalf of loved ones who've been detained. Other times, people are released shortly after being detained by ICE.
Typically, it's going to be someone that has had no criminal record, perhaps. Maybe has U.S. citizen children.
I spoke with farm workers who fear getting detained on their way to or from work, and due to that fear, they asked not to have their remarks included. Lopez says the U.S. government has been beefing up immigration enforcement since the 1980s, but she says the Trump administration has taken it to a new level.
We are moving towards an era of more and more enforcement and less actual congressional action.
Dennis Johnston at Johnston Farms agrees with Lopez on that front. As for President Trump, well, Johnston says he votes on more than just immigration.
Agriculture is generally supportive of Trump reducing regulation on our industry, but we generally are worried that his stance on immigration will be even more restrictive to the agriculture workforce.
Despite all that, he's been sticking with Trump, whom he voted for in 2016. And Johnston says he plans to cast his vote again for Trump this fall. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Madi Bolaños.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. One of the most vulnerable House Democrats in California this year is Representative T.J. Cox, who narrowly defeated Republican incumbent Congressman David Valadao 2 years ago in California's 21st District. Reporter Alex Hall, KQED's Central Valley correspondent, has this report on a rematch between the two candidates.
A cattle auction is set to begin at Overland Stockyard in Hanford, about 40 minutes south of Fresno. Former Republican Congressman David Valadao has pretty high name recognition here. Many people, like walnut farmer Vicki Stanfield, know him personally.
He's local, Hanford. Kids went to Hanford High.
Democrat T.J. Cox unseated Valadao by less than 1,000 votes in 2018. Now they're facing off again. Constituent Durbin Pedro works in the dairy industry. He thinks Cox has done an okay job. But
for the agriculture issues, I think he's fallen a little short.
His issue? Water.
For this part of the valley, we need somebody who's more aggressive to get more water for our farmers and our communities.
This is a rare swing district in California, with all or parts of Fresno, Kings, Kern, and Tulare counties. 4 years ago, voters here re-elected Valadao, but also voted for Democrat Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. In Huron, a farm worker community in the district, almost everyone who lives here is Latino, including Luis Enrique Gutierrez. He works at a furniture store that now sells toilet paper and hand sanitizer to stay open as an essential business. He says he'll vote for T.J. Cox because he's a Democrat, unlike Valadao, a Republican who supports Trump. Gutierrez says most voters here don't like President Trump because of what he has said about Mexican immigrants. Because Republicans represent Trump, we will always be against Republicans, he says. In campaign ads, Valadao has portrayed himself as almost nonpartisan.
David Valadao is different. An independent problem solver, he worked with President Obama to bring more water to the Central Valley.
Unlike 2 years ago, when Valadao distanced himself from Trump, this time...
You also have somebody here who's another warrior.
When Trump was in Bakersfield in February to talk about bringing more water to farmers, he called Valadao up on stage to join him.
All his life, and he's running for the 21st Congressional District, David Valadao.
He's kind of between a rock and a hard place.
Tom Holyoke is a Fresno State political science professor.
He needs to keep his base in that district, you know, the hardcore Republicans and Trump supporters, but then he also needs to capture some Democratic voters, something Valadao used to be pretty good at.
Paul Mitchell of Political Data, a bipartisan voter information company, says Democratic registration went up in the 21st district ahead of this year's primary. But that doesn't guarantee Cox will win again.
There are people who are Democratic because of maybe they're a union member. Maybe they just have always been Democratic. But being Democratic doesn't mean that you're for AOC and the Green New Deal when you're living in the Central Valley.
Both Cox and Valadao have been embroiled in personal financial controversies. But in a year when voters are focused on the pandemic and the presidential election, it may just come down to who ends up voting. For the California Report, I'm Alex Hall in Fresno.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. There is a prevailing narrative that young people in our country are not politically engaged and are unlikely to vote. But I recently spoke with three individuals who are actively challenging that assumption. Radhi S. Patel, a 24-year-old coordinator for Sunrise Kern in Bakersfield, Alexandria Ben, a 25-year-old community advocate in Fresno, and Joshua Slack, a 25-year-old activist who co-organized a protest in downtown Fresno following the death of George Floyd. Joshua started the conversation by sharing what motivated him to become politically active.
I would say that the spark that really ignited the journey was the Trayvon Martin case. I just remember I was graduating high school by the time that the case was reaching a national level and the verdict came out. And that was the first time that something I had felt any kind of personal investment in as a young person, and seeing just how flawed the justice system really was in the sense of not necessarily doing what's right in the eyes of many. And so my transition into college is when I found out that there's a lot of people that felt the same way as me, because when I was going to high school in Lemoore, California, it's a very conservative-ish area. And so it felt like my voice was kind of being drowned out within that city. So when I moved down to Fresno, in the Fresno State, I found that there's a lot more of the Black population on our campus that felt the same way. And so I started to attend different speeches and different meetups that a lot of the Black students would have on the campus, and some of the Black faculty as well. And I also was taking a critical race theory class that was really enlightening my perception of what was going on in this country, not just in the present, but also in the past, and how the past affects the present and affects the future. Then the Mike Brown situation happened the end of my freshman year, that summer of college, so in 2014. And from there, I really just felt the sensation of that there's something that I needed to do. So I started to become a lot more politically engaged on the campus, started attending protests, started to even speak at protests, started to do a lot of different performance art. And so the Mike Brown situation, everything going on with Ferguson really started that. And then, of course, everything that happened with Freddie Gray and Sandra Bland and so many other countless Black lives started to happen. And it just felt like we were reaching at a boiling point already back in 2014 to 2015 with the first instance of the Black Lives Matter movement. And then, of course, years later, we have the situation that happened with George Floyd and what happened with Breonna Taylor. And then another wave of the Black Lives Matter movement happened. And we all know how that has been affecting us throughout this pandemic. And just using that moment to be able to get back into a form of political engagement as well as activism and resistance through different art forms, through different uses of speech, really has ignited the flame in me again in order to do something about this. And so just from learning different things, changing my circles, that I would stay a lot more politically engaged, and figuring out just how systemic a lot of this is and just how intentional it seems a lot of this has become because of the different policies that we have, because of the different people that we elect into office, and of the different laws that are being made, to just realize that this has been affecting us a lot longer. And the only way that we can do this the only way that the system has allowed us to do things is through voting. So that has kind of opened my eyes, because I was somebody that really was against the idea of voting, because myself as a Black man in America, I felt that there was really no need, because we've been in this situation for years and years and years when it comes down to voting. And so I realized that I'm not just voting for my sake, because it was very selfish of me to think that way, but also the other people's sake, because there are people that are affected that aren't just me by the different policies that go on. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
Long story.
Alexandria Ben, does Joshua's story resonate with you as well?
Oh, yes. He piqued my interest as soon as he said Trayvon Martin. For me, I followed that whole entire case from beginning to end. And I remember vividly being in my grandmother's living room with my family, watching the verdict and just seeing not guilty. For me, we've been in this state of just terror, just constantly. And the constant, no convictions, like the continuous pattern. I just feel like as a Black woman, it's scary, not only for myself, but like my future children. Like, it's obvious we are not safe. And I've been speaking about this ever since Breonna Taylor's verdict came out. It took us 6 months, like 6 months of just waiting around, just like hoping that the system will do something, you know, do what's right. And nothing still happens, you know. And she was sleeping. But I'm going to introduce myself. So my name is Alexandra Vinn. And what began my political journey, I was the president of the Pan-African Student Union.
And just to be clear, this was at Fresno City College, right?
Yes, at Fresno City College. And I saw the relationship between just Black people. Like, as the president, I went up to people that looked just like me, and they looked at me as if, like, I was trash or, you know, like, why are you talking to me? And, like, for me, I was just like, that shouldn't be, especially if you look like me and we go through the same struggles. We shouldn't fight amongst each other, especially if you don't know me. So, like, that led me to do our annual event called Bringing Black Back. And that event just consists of poetry. It was live entertainment from students at Fresno City College, Fresno State, and throughout the community. And, like, within that space, we're actually able to bring multicultural everyone together. I remember both events. We had the whole entire free speech area in the back of Fresno City College just packed to the point where you can see the people still coming up, even from the front. And it's just, it was a lot of people and there's really no space pre-COVID, FYI.
I assumed.
And it's just like, for me, it gave me joy because Black skin is unknown to us. We're still understanding who we are, how, like, for me, I learned myself through my hair. And for a Black woman, I have 4C hair, so that's kind of like kinky hair. For me, when I was younger, I used to hate it because I'm a dark-skinned woman. And the colorism that, like, I didn't really realize it was colorism at first. But colorism really played a really big, huge role while I was younger. I always imagined myself as a light-skinned woman walking around, knowing that I was Black, knowing that I was a Black woman, and that was not changing. So that fast forward to now. I mentioned Breonna Taylor. For me, I'm not okay. I'm not okay with just how everything is. It makes me scared. It makes me uncomfortable to know that, like, I can be sleeping in my house and get shot, and the bullets that go into the wall next door can be get more justice than me, you know? It just doesn't make sense. I vote because I know that no background deal that the police union can ever do is not more powerful than people's vote. That's right. The most important, like, that's most important, you know, that I want everyone to know.
Let me just jump in. I'd love to hear from Vridhi Patel. Tell us about your journey to activism.
I will say, I don't even like calling myself an activist. I like calling myself an organizer because I'll start from the beginning. Really, it was just a year ago because the narrative that is really kind of pushed on everyone is that even me, you know, I'm only 24, I've only gotten to vote in basically one presidential election. For the frustrating part was that they always push that narrative. I went to college in St. Louis. So the shooting of Michael Brown happened there. And I remember I lived across from three men, three baseball players at our college because I ran track and cross country. And in that apartment next door to me for the baseball players was multiple Confederate flag, multiple Confederate memorabilia, and really just a very public display of this isn't that big of a deal, we don't care. And it was really disheartening to see, but the issue that really frustrated me is that all I thought that I had as my voice was voting. And for me, that's all I thought I had. I was like, okay, well, I'm voting, you know, that's, I did it. Like, I did what I was supposed to do. I voted in this presidential election. We still lost. I voted in this city council race. We still lost. And I really didn't learn organizing as a facet to really change the public narrative and engage the public in a participatory process when it comes to defunding the police and defunding local city police and defunding the sheriff. Really pushing the fact that Erica Chenoweth, the political scientist, has on multiple occasions done research that very clearly says that if you engage the population, at least 3.5% of the population, which here in Kern County, that's roughly 31,000 people, which is less than one Bakersfield city ward. And if you engage that population, engage a 3.5% of the population at least, is 100% successful. And really, I got so frustrated, as many of my, like, people that I organize in a youth setting with were like, we voted. We did our part. And yet still, we're building into a system that doesn't speak for us. We're building into a system that is broken, while America is a failed state. When Alexandria said it very well, when the bullets that were fired get more justice than Breonna Taylor, we're feeding into this system that is already corrupt. So I think for me, waking up every morning, I got involved first with the Burning Campaign, and now I organize a lot with Sunrise, with our local Sunrise Hub. But for me, and I think a lot of youth just, one, don't have access to how to organize. Two, like for me, I got really involved because every morning I saw elected officials be provided the policy platforms they need to put forward to really achieve collective liberation, especially with Movement for Black Lives recently. They put out policy platforms at the local, state, and federal level. And yet none of our local, state, or federal representatives, they've literally been handed what they need to do, and they still can't do it. And for me, every day waking up seeing political and elected officials do basically to virtually nothing, if not make it worse, if not make systemic oppression worse, while doing nothing to fix it, is enraging me to a point where I you know, it's enraging, and it's enraging a lot of people, like in the youth setting especially. And what they don't realize is 70% of Kern County is below the age of 45, and we're coming whether they like it or not.
Just in a minute or two, what are your thoughts about the impact your generation can have on your communities and on your country? Alexandria, let's start with you.
Okay, so this election, I feel like it's the most important. Not only everyone voting is under the age of 40, so this basically the millennial vote. Our vote right now is going to dictate what we do for the next 4 years, and who knows, next 8 years. And like, in all honesty, I feel like we don't have choices, but we got one choice, and that's all that matters. It's like first time we let it happen. We seen this man running for office. Everybody said, he ain't going to win. Like, stop tripping. And election night came along. This man won. And it's just like, I wrote Bernie in. So it's just like, I was a part of the problem. I didn't want to vote for anybody else but Bernie. And that was my problem. I was just one, like, I was one-sided. So it's just like, now I know my duty. Not only to my future generations, but I know what my vote takes, and I know what I got to do. So it's just like, we got to do it, and it's just like, got to hope for the best.
Ready?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important that every single one of our, like, 18 to 45-year-olds vote, especially 18 to 35. But for me, as I'm sure Joshua and Alexandria are tired of, I'm tired of having to choose the lesser of two evils. And I know I'm voting for Biden. I can make that very clear. But I do not like him. I do not like Biden. And yet I still have to vote for him for the greater good. But I am tired of seeing, as I'm sure Alexandria and Joshua have said, we're getting people out to vote for sure. But I don't think moderates have really kind of honed in on, hey, if you don't vote, the world is going to fall into shambles. And if you organize or if you've canvassed before, you know the way to get people out to vote is not by shaming them or guilting them, but it's really about reaching to them at a personal level. And so I'm worried that moderates, especially with Biden's camp, are going to shame and guilt people into voting for them, when really, I really hope, like, what we're doing locally is really reaching out to people personally, talking to them at a personal level. But I'm scared, because we were going over election scenarios, and it is a very realistic option that Trump wins, and that is going to throw us into a fascist dictatorship that I'm not ready for, and that many people of color, Black, Indigenous, and low-income communities will not be able to survive. And we're just really trying to get out the vote by talking to people personally. But I'm scared. I'm scared. I'm scared.
And Joshua, what are your thoughts as we enter into this election process? Are you scared too?
I'm not scared, honestly. I'm not scared, win or lose, as far as like whoever takes the seat. I'm not necessarily scared because really my experience and really the whole Black experience has never really, it seems that almost that we are in a weird spot because a lot of people are fighting for a Black vote. And then we kind of get reduced to kind of just semantics as far as a Black vote or the Latino vote, or when it comes down to any people of color vote, it seems that we're getting reduced less and less than. And so at the end of the day, sometimes it just feels like, you know, it doesn't feel like this particular system, as far as the political system, is going to really change. And like Rudy said, when people are expressing themselves as saying that they don't want to vote, it feels that there's almost a shame that comes with it, and they shame people into voting, which is not a good practice right now. And I feel that with this election, I think that this will be the election, regardless of who wins or who doesn't, that really opens up the eyes of the people that are witnessing it, just how much of a flawed system this is. And so the reason why I'm not scared is because I believe that there will be, especially our generation, the millennials, who are really the majority voters at this point, I believe that it will be our generation to really turn the tide when it comes down to exactly how we do this voting process, if there is even going to be a voting process, or just, I have no idea. I'm not, and I don't want to waste my energy really being afraid of the future, but I do want to prepare for it. And I think that when it comes down to it, really what we have to do at this moment is use the tools that we are given to us in order to fight for what's right, and in order to go ahead and make sure that the laws that we want, the policies that we want, especially that serve our communities and locally, are what's being done right now.
Well, Alexandria Benn, Ridhi Patel, and Joshua Slack, thank you so much for sharing your perspectives with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Voters in the 22nd Congressional District will decide next month between Devin Nunes, who has represented the district since 2003, and Phil Arbayo, who runs a small business in financial services. Nunes's campaign did not respond to our request for an interview, but I did talk to Arbayo. Here's a portion of that conversation.
Going into this campaign season, we surveyed our listeners to find out what issues mattered most to them and what they would ask candidates if given the opportunity. So many of the questions that I have for you today are based on that listener feedback.
Okay.
So first of all, just tell me a little bit about yourself and what are the skills and knowledge and experience that you would bring to Congress?
Yeah, so I'm a Hispanic business owner here in the Central Valley. That's my day job when I'm not running for Congress, which is mostly a full-time job these days. I sit on two committees already for the city of Fresno. One I do chair. I'm an active board member with the Central California Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. I'm raising two young kids here. I have a almost 7-year-old who's in first grade now, and a 2-year-old running around the house. You know, we're trying to corral during distance learning times. And, you know, I think my business acumen, if you want to call it that, being able to bring people together in their best interest to move forward in their goals and their needs and wants is what, you know, is going to make me an effective leader here for the Central Valley.
So I would like to move on to some of the big issues that we've been facing. Of course, the biggest issue this year has been COVID-19.
Yeah.
We did get a question from a listener in Visalia, which is this: how would you address economic recovery and the effect the pandemic has had on education?
Well, I mean, the best thing we can do right now, you know, I'm a firm believer in the science behind COVID-19, and I think it's important to listen to the experts and the scientists and really do what is necessary to make sure that our businesses get back to opening their doors. I'm a firm believer in small businesses and them leading the way in our local economies. And they are. I believe that in the end, they're gonna lead the way back by all of us participating, though, and, you know, socially distancing and wearing your mask and washing your hands as well. I do believe that it's gonna be up to those in business to, you know, provide a safe environment for us to visit. And when it comes to education, you know, we are feeling the effects right now. You know, my 7-year-old who is in first grade, you know, my wife wasn't able to go back to work because she has to be home with our son while I campaign to help him with his distance learning. So we understand and we want him to go back to school. He misses his friends. He wants to be around them. But we know what's most important, not only for our family, but for other families, his friends' families, the staff, the teachers, is to make sure that we get through this virus. And you know, we're hoping that when fall of 2021 comes around, that this nation has come together to control this virus so that our children can get back in school.
So we got another question from Visalia that addresses another huge story this summer, the civic unrest following the deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and others. So the question is this: how would you restore social peace while also addressing the valid concerns about abuse of power and racial problems?
Yeah, Breonna Taylor's death, the death of George Floyd and many others during this time is unfortunate, and things haven't changed much in this country, and that's unfortunate for the African-American community. And, you know, I fully support the Black Lives Matter movement and, you know, the peaceful protests that are going on out there around the country, and we've seen here right in the Central Valley. We have to address this from the very top. We need the rhetoric to change from the very top and to bring people together. Right now, unfortunately, we have an administration that their best course of action, they believe for them in their reelection progress or perspective, is to divide this country. And, you know, we are so much better than what this administration believes that we are, especially right here in the Central Valley. This is a very special place in my heart. I believe in the people here of the Central Valley, especially this 22nd Congressional District. I know in our hearts that we can do better and that we want to do better. No one wants to see the violence that has broken out in some of these major cities come here to the Central Valley. And I don't believe it. I mean, you know, all things considered, I don't believe that's going to happen. But what we need to do, though, is we need to start by, you know, changing our elected representatives from the top on down, who believe that it's time for, you know, to end systemic racism and start thinking about how we police our communities in terms of moving resources from maybe an all police budget to more of a social services budget in combined with those two to really take on community policing in the Central Valley.
Well, let's talk about the campaign. It's, you know, you're facing an incredibly well-funded, long-time incumbent candidate in the middle of a pandemic, which I'm sure is going to throw a wrinkle in any kind of campaign strategy.
Sure.
How are things going and how are you feeling about your chances of winning?
Well, things are going real great here, you know, especially I guess since our primary win back in March, which seems so long ago. You know, there's been so much support and activity on this campaign. Yes, it is not a conventional race. We have to do more digitally. We have to do more phone banking. We have to do more text banking because we're not going to be out there canvassing, unfortunately, because we want to make sure that everyone's safe. You know, again, I believe that in 2018, the people of the Central Valley, there was an awakening. When you presented them with a different option, they understood that they don't have to continue to keep voting for the incumbent, who's basically been a no-show for the last decade, probably decade and a half, in terms of being an actual representative. And that's what we're doing again this year. We're going to take that momentum, which got us about as close as anyone had ever gone in 2018. We're taking that momentum and we're building off of it. And, you know, I believe we're throwing a better candidate into the mix here, you know, one who does represent the Valley in the majority, the minority majority, a Latino, a business owner, a small business owner, someone who's present, someone who's invested, raising his own family here, and whose wife is also involved in the community as well. You know, my story of growing up as in a single parent household, having to work my way through college, you know, full time to graduate Fresno State here. I'm the only candidate in this race who actually graduated from Fresno State, I believe is a story that everybody can relate to and on the hard work. And that's what we're doing in our campaign. You know, our opponent might be well funded, but what we're going to be able to do is outwork him to get our message out there. He's relying on his name and his voters to bail him out again this year. But I don't believe that the voters are willing to bail him out in a presidential year anymore. And they want real representation and some pride to come back to the Central Valley.
Well, Phil Arbayo, candidate for the 22nd Congressional District, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. It was a pleasure being on here.
During my conversation with Arbayo, we also discussed issues including affordable housing, wildfires, and the political divide in D.C. To hear the full unedited interview, visit our website, kvpr.org. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. When we quantify the toll that COVID-19 is taking on our communities, we typically turn to official statistics like confirmed cases, hospitalization rates, and of course, death counts. But what if the final tally is an undercount and the death toll is really much higher? FM89's Carrie Klein looked into the numbers this week and is here to tell us about them as part of our weekly COVID-19 update. Welcome back, Carrie.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks.
So as usual, let's start with a COVID-19 update for the San Joaquin Valley.
Okay, so we're continuing to see improvements. You know, week after week, it's good news here. So our new cases and our local deaths continue to decline. Hospitalizations and ICUs are staying steady for right now, which is neither good nor bad necessarily. But good news though is that we've seen no significant bump from Labor Day, at least according to health officials in Fresno and Kern counties. And when it comes to the state's reopening blueprint, there have been some changes in local counties. And so while most counties have been in the purple tier, kind of the most restrictive one, since the blueprint was unveiled in late August, Fresno has now advanced to red and Mariposa has advanced to yellow being the least restrictive. And so that means that in Fresno County, places of worship, nail and hair salons, movie theaters, they can all open indoors with reduced capacity. Bars, however, are still closed if they don't serve meals, and schools are set to open within 2 weeks if they choose to. And in Mariposa, most businesses can open indoors, but with some reduced capacities, and schools are open. Also, Merced and Kern counties have qualified to move into the red tier, but they must be at their current levels for 14 consecutive days in order to advance. They're still in the purple tier until then. And then the rest of the counties in our area are still in the purple, the most restrictive level.
So even though fewer people are dying of COVID each week than earlier in the pandemic, I understand you spent some time looking at death trends in the state. Tell me about what you found.
That's right. So public health officials, in counties and at the state level, they've been keeping track of deaths officially linked to the coronavirus. And those are tabulated based off of death certificates. So that's where a doctor or a medical examiner determines if COVID was the leading factor in that death. But not all agencies are consistent in how they judge a COVID death. The numbers might be subject to human error. And so I was really looking for a way to get some more context on these numbers. And I found that through simply the number of people dying in general. So the state keeps track of all these deaths every month, every year, broken down by all sorts of demographics. And so I went back a few years to ask the question, are people dying during the pandemic at a higher or lower rate than usual? And so I took the average deaths from 2017 to 2019 and looked at how 2020 compared.
And what did you find?
Well, it's probably not all that surprising. More people have died this year than in years past, pretty significantly. If we look just at the pandemic period, March through August, around 2,000 more people died this year than in that same time period in those previous years. And that's just here in the San Joaquin Valley. There have been thousands more excess deaths statewide.
So I feel like the obvious reason for that is COVID. Can the pandemic be the explanation for all of those extra deaths?
If we go off of the official tally, no. As of the end of August, only around 1,000 people had died of COVID in the Valley, leaving another 1,000 unaccounted for. So I called up some people who know more about all this than I do. Irene Yen is a social epidemiologist at UC Merced who focuses on social determinants of health. And she said it's likely that many of those excess deaths were probably indirectly related to the pandemic.
Say somebody has end-stage kidney disease and needs to have dialysis regularly, and maybe they were afraid to go, for example, and does that mean that they went less than they clinically needed to go and then were compromised? I also heard reports of people not wanting to show up in emergency rooms because with other conditions because they were afraid of exposure, but that meant that they delayed seeking care.
And of course, we're facing a major mental health crisis right now, more suicides, suicide attempts, substance abuse. And Yen makes the argument that those deaths could certainly be indirectly related to the pandemic and its effects on society and families and finances and things like that.
Okay, so these numbers you're talking about are all focused on this entire region. Were you able to drill down into which demographic groups may be dying at higher rates than others?
Well, the majority of these excess deaths were in the Hispanic population. That's not all that surprising, though, given that the majority of our population is Hispanic. But drill down deeper, and the numbers actually vary a lot geographically. So in some counties, Hispanics are far overrepresented in these deaths, like in Fresno and Kings. In Kern and Tulare counties, however, it appears to be whites who are dying at the fastest rate. And then when it comes to African Americans, they are dying at a disproportionately high rate across the valley. It's also notable that the San Joaquin Valley as a whole appears to be dying at a faster rate than the state. So while we only make up about 8% of the state's population here, we account for 13% of those excess deaths. Yen says this is likely because we have so many backbone industries requiring essential workers here in this area, and that many of those workers are in communities of color.
People of color are taking a bigger hit, shall we say. They're getting higher proportions are getting sick. They're getting sicker and they're dying at higher rates.
I should also note that although we know these patterns are borne out elsewhere and that we know communities of color in the Valley are disproportionately testing positive for COVID-19, most Valley counties have not actually revealed the racial or ethnic breakdown of who's dying of the virus. So once we get that, we'll really be able to drill down deeper into the direct and indirect causes of these excess deaths.
So talking about race and ethnicity, of course, brings up questions of equity. What is being done to protect those communities from the virus?
Well, to answer that question, let me introduce you to someone. Tanya Pacheco-Werner is the co-assistant director of the Central Valley Health Policy Institute at Fresno State, and she's very concerned about these communities.
What that tells me is that we are not reaching these folks in time for them to either get the information, get the care, or get just any sort of education or medical intervention to prevent their deaths.
She is one of the leads on the COVID-19 Equity Project, which has partnered Fresno County health officials with nonprofits that represent various demographic groups. That's because she says each group has very different needs, especially those who may not speak English or have easy access to technology.
I'll give you an example. We brought on our Punjabi serving organization, Jakara Movement, after we saw that families were leaving the hospital without knowing that they were actually positive and that meant that they needed to stay away from the rest of their family. And so then they were infecting the rest of their family. And we were hearing from the Latino community that people were being asked to sign up for taking a COVID test through an email, but they didn't have an email address, or they opened one to get the test but didn't know how to access it again, so never got their results.
The Equity Project is offering direct support and social services to these communities related to the virus, and it's also been brought on to do contact tracing in a hopefully more culturally sensitive way. Outside of that, Kern County, for example, has created a Latino COVID-19 task force, and other county health departments in our area have created their own campaigns to target Hispanics and other groups.
Well, Carrie, as always, thank you so much for your reporting.
Yeah, thank you.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
You're listening to Grammy Award-winning jazz vocalist Gregory Porter singing Happy Birthday, not to a person, but to a university. This performance took place yesterday evening as part of a virtual celebration of California State University Bakersfield's 50th anniversary, an event that included a speech from Sir Richard Branson. Earlier this week, I had the opportunity to speak with the university's president, Lynette Zalesny, about the milestone celebration and how students are coping with distance education. President Zalesny, first of all, thank you so much for being on the show.
It's just an absolute pleasure to be with you. Thanks for the invitation.
So give us a sense of the history of CSU Bakersfield and how it came to be.
Well, it's a great story. And we're really indebted to some Valley leaders who really were very instrumental in making sure that the South Valley, the metropolitan area that did not have a four-year university, had opportunities for their youth to go to a four-year public institution, a regional comprehensive. And we're really indebted to the leadership of advocates Dorothy Donahoe and also Senator Walter Stern. And about 50 years ago, weather was very similar to what we're experiencing this week. It's hot, but out here on the southwest side of Bakersfield, then Governor Ronald Reagan came and did the ribbon cutting. And you could see in the plains just beyond the fields that we were gifted many of the Basque farmers with their sheep. So we have, again, just a beautiful beginning. At that time, we had a core faculty that was highly select and about 1,000 students that were ready to start school. And we have certainly used that foundation as a great springboard for leveraging where we're at in celebration of this 50th anniversary.
So no one could have predicted back then that by the time the university would be celebrating its 50th anniversary, you would be, of course, in the middle of a global pandemic. I have to ask, how is distance education going for students and faculty? And what are your expectations at this point about reopening?
Well, I'm really, really proud of the transition that we made at CSUB. It was one in which we really showed our leadership, and the faculty and staff stepped forward, and we had really a transition that went remarkably smooth, and it's because of the faculty and staff. They immediately immersed themselves in professional development to convert classes to virtual and to make sure that they were offering very high quality educational opportunities for our students. And our students, likewise, are very resilient. They're very flexible. That's the people here in the South Valley of California. And their hardworking, hard ethic really worked for them in terms of doing what they needed to do to move forward, to complete their classes, and to be very positive and optimistic about this is perhaps a time of learning new technologies, and that the work world may never look the same again. And so they were experiencing opportunities that were actually enriched. So I would say that we have really done a remarkable job. We began our fall semester with a record enrollment at CSUB. And I should also note that it was a record enrollment for graduate students. This also says a lot about our distinction here at CSUB. So though we wouldn't have predicted it, I think as CSUB, we are known for being in the center of innovation. And I think we really showed that was our DNA when we transitioned as we needed to prioritize health and safety during this pandemic. So we're doing really quite well.
What role do you see CSUB taking in helping the South Valley's economy start to rebound from the recession that we're experiencing as a result of COVID-19?
Well, we're probably the key driver of workforce revitalization once pandemic is over and we're ready to transition back to work. And we will be key to a thriving California here in the South Valley. And one of the things that I know is that this is one of the messages since we began with our virtual instruction that I was out in the community sharing is this is not the time to pause. This is the time to move forward very aggressively with your higher education. Have that degree ready when it is time to open up the workforce. And as we know, the South Valley is challenged by the number of the population that has a four-year college degree. So we're really, really trying to accelerate that work. And I am very proud of our students. As you know, we have our record enrollment, about 12,000 students. But one of the things that makes me most proud at this 50th anniversary is that we have 56,000 alum. And the vast majority of those alumni from CSUB continue to live and serve in the South Valley of Kern County in Bakersfield. And so think of that huge impact, and also think about these record number of students who are going to be ready with their degree, with their experience, with their ethic of serving and of leadership, ethical leadership, to move forward and to serve this state. So I'm very, very proud of our students. And I'm very proud that they're choosing CSUB. And I'm very proud of our faculty for working to get our students to the finish line. And we will be key to the revitalization of our state. And the university plays, again, a key role in workforce development in this region.
Before we wrap up, I'd be remiss in not asking for your reaction to the news that your colleague, Fresno State President Joseph Castro, will soon be leading the entire CSU system as its chancellor.
Well, I am President Castro's biggest fan, and I was definitely rooting for him. He was definitely my first choice, and he is the man of the hour. He's the perfect fit for this position, leading our state university, California State University system. And he will bring, I think, a strong leadership. He has, of course, lived the journey of many of our students. He has a strong championship mindset about student success, and he'll particularly be focused on our underserved students. So I am absolutely delighted and thrilled by his appointment. And of course, this again will be a plus for those of us that serve in the Central California Valley, because this is where he's from, and this is where he served as a president, and this is where he has friends like me that he'll remember as we're moving forward in our work at the CSU. So it's an absolutely extraordinary choice, and I couldn't be more excited for him.
Well, California State University Bakersfield President Lynette Zalesny, thank you so much for being with us. And again, congratulations on the 50th anniversary of the university.
Kathleen, thanks so much.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. And we'd love to hear from you, especially your experiences around the pandemic. Send us a voice memo on our app. Just hit the audience feedback icon and record. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Laura Satsui, Carrie Klein, and Madi Bolaños. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, acknowledging the vital work of local public health departments to keep Californians safe during the pandemic. On the web at chcf.org.